Welcome to Gonkcast, a long-form discussion podcast about the music of English electronic duo Autechre, album by album, EP by EP. I'm Gabe.
I'm Dan.
And this is an episode all about set B of AE 2022 Autechre's ongoing, ever-expanding live-slash-not-live project. For those following along at home, set B was performed in London, aka London B, the second London performance, and in Venice. Side note, don't confuse the B sets, when they played two shows in one night, with set B. Like listener Ian, who wrote in with detailed thoughts about Lisbon B, thinking it was an example of set B, then quickly wrote back saying, "I just began reading more of the AE pages and realized that Lisbon B is not actually set B. Damn, they make this confusing." Boy, do they.
Yeah, that's summing it up.
Don't forget that we've launched a Patreon where for just $5 a month, you can get bi-weekly bonus episodes on AE-adjacent music and vote on the music we cover. Last week, for example, we did an episode on Rush Up Edge by The Tuss, one of those hidden gems in the discography of Richard D. James. That was fun, wasn't it, Dan?
Yeah, it was. So join the Patreon. There's also some other stuff on there. I figured out how to make a chat, but, you know, like a old school chat room. So that's for Patreon members only. So if you want to ASL or whatever, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny to kind of think about the fact that we've never done like a full actual discussion of Aphex Twin. That was like our first time, even though we did this podcast for so long. And of course, we've referred to him so many times, but there was something fun about actually talking about him like in a full episode, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
So that's the kind of thing you get if you subscribe. Head over to patreon.com/gonkcast and join us. Shout out, by the way, to our newest subscribers: Joe, Sunil, Tom, Ian, Aaron, Robert, and Josh. Now, as a note about what you can expect moving forward, we are not going to have a new episode next week because we're both going to be traveling for the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday, but we'll be back right after that with another bonus episode on the new 10 Tricks Point Never album, Tranquilizer, which was a topic chosen by our paid subscribers. I told you, you get to vote. And actually, we have such a small batch right now that your vote is worth a hell of a lot. Okay, so get on over there if you want to have like a big influence on what we cover. Right after that, we're going to do another main episode on the mighty set C from 2022-. So send us your thoughts on OPN as well as Autechre so we can add them to the conversation. And remember, it's really helpful when you specify when you're commenting on the whole thing, specific track, etc. Makes it very easy to slot in, as a lot of you guys made it easy for me this week, which I really appreciate. Comment on Patreon with your thoughts or email us, as always, at gonkcastpod@gmail.com. Dan, I thought we should start with a couple just corrections slash leftovers from last time slash maybe news items. First off, you wanted to apologize for repeatedly confusing last episode the words Patreon and patron.
Yeah. I guess I every time called the people Patreons, but you would be a patron. That's confusing. I do know the difference. I'm not. I'm not that stupid. I just don't read well, I guess.
All right. Correction made. Next, a news item. You may have seen that Mark Broom uploaded his live set. He uploaded it to SoundCloud, shared it on the Autechre Reddit. I'm going to include a link in the show notes of this episode. I wanted to mention, by the way, that when we did the Tuss episode last week, that was inspired by the fact that Mark Broom spun a couple of those tracks in his opening set, and it kind of reminded me of the Tuss. Listener Robert wrote in to ask, which tracks did Mark Broom play at the AE gigs? It's funny because I thought he only played the first two tracks, which is, I guess, more evidence that those are kind of the standouts of the collection. But it turns out, actually, from looking at his sort of set list, that he also played a little bit of Deathfuck, the track known as Deathfuck, which I didn't even notice. But so there was quite a lot of that album represented on his set.
Yeah. It's cool. I remember when we saw him in Atlanta, you pointed out at least one of the Tuss songs to me in the moment. So I'll give you that. Props.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly didn't even remember it was the Tuss. I was just like, oh, this is Aphex Twin, but I didn't like place where it was. But I don't know, it's sort of fun to be reminded. So yeah, definitely check that out. It's a great listen, a fantastic set. More stuff up front here. We heard from listener Sunil, and actually a couple listeners, about this. Listener Sunil writes, an opinion on naming conventions. Personally, I think it would be a good idea to utilize or at least mention the fan track titles in the footnotes below the tables on AE pages. First, because it's more memorable and digestible than, say, numbers 2 through 4. Second, because listeners can find any of these sections on YouTube. Like, if you were to mention the core scene section of Venice 23, one could immediately search Venice core scene and listen to the segment you were talking about. Third, I do think those subdivisions make more sense, and you seem to agree in how you group numbers together in talking about set A. Just my opinion, though, I may be biased from being part of the very niche group of people who discuss AE Live on the Discord regularly. Everyone uses the fan titles there. We also heard from listener Marcy, who said, similarly, my only suggestion is maybe you could mention the fan names for tracks, as in the TTT Dash compilation. IMO, it makes a bit clearer which parts you're talking about, especially for those who prefer that comp as the definitive version of these sets, like me. It's just all around high quality and convenient. I would definitely recommend it to anyone who's hesitant to jump into the soundboards. Yes, on that note, shout out user, I think it was like Fefeta Lexis or something like that, for putting together the TTT Dash album. I'm going to put the link to that in the show notes where you can read about it and then download it for free for yourself. I also wanted to read this message from listener Ian, who says, the work done on AE pages and Reddit to see the way this whole project is built and how it divides up by track is extraordinary. Then to see that each track has been separated out and given its own artwork is just next level stuff. Absolutely agreed. I mean, I find, Dan, that, I don't know, this is my own problem, but I often find that fan-made Autechre tracks, you know, like track titles, they just seem like a little bit like transparent to me. Like, I can tell they're fake. But having kind of like gotten these emails and listened to it this week with those kind of fan names in mind, I definitely agree that they make it a whole lot easier to digest this thing. Do you have any thoughts about that? Maybe the practice of like fan splitting tracks in general?
Yeah, same as you. I generally shy away from you know, fan edits and things. I feel like when an artist creates art, you shouldn't mess with it. But when they do it in the most confusing way possible, that's impossible to talk about. It works. And so I think, you know, it probably is, especially for a podcast where you're just hearing us talk about something you listen to, it makes a lot of sense to use those names, I think.
Yeah, and I find myself this week, since receiving these emails, literally starting to think of the tracks in terms of these like fan names. And yeah, you're totally right that it makes a big difference. So we're going to start mentioning those. More upfront stuff here. Listener Sunil, again, wrote in to say, maybe I'm just AE Live brained, but I do hear a fair bit of melody in set A, perhaps because everything is so toned. But I hear melody right from the get-go and lots of little melodies throughout. Sometimes they're quiet, sometimes they're composed of sounds that wouldn't typically be used to make melodies, toms, percussion, strange noises, etc. I think Prin Kerr, that's one of those fan names, which is tracks 9 through 11 on AE pages, contains some of the most traditional sounding melodies, but they tend to be quiet and to fade in and out of the music. Honestly, this was another case where, since getting this email and starting to think about it more, I think I agree that actually we kept describing set A as like kind of lacking in melody, but I can kind of see how it's like just a different form of melody. Like, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, this is difficult to talk about anyways, because, you know, like the listener said, sometimes like those percussive sounds are like melodic in a sense. So I don't think there's not like, you know, it's not like hearing a keyboard run or something, you know, like it's not such an apparent melody. And maybe that's what we meant when we said lacking in melody, you know, lacking in traditional melody.
Right. Not traditional melodies. Melodies you really got to kind of like listen closely for or search for. And, you know, I think like, you know, Sunil is kind of reflecting the fact that sometimes you can't tell if you are like, you're like, your brain is adding a melody where it's not actually there. But maybe that's part of the fun of listening to this. But I actually kind of feel, and we'll talk about this, but that set B is more like explicitly melodic in a couple places. But it actually sort of helped me see it the way that Sunil is seeing it. That like, after listening to set B a bunch and then going back to set A, I'm like, oh yeah, I can kind of like recognize the melodies here that I actually don't think I was recognizing fully before.
Yeah, totally.
All right, Well, shall we jump into Seppi?
Yeah. Last time we went deep into set A of the 2022 Dash project, which Ottecker toured around Europe, Japan, and Australia in 2022 and 2023. Set B picks up where set A left off, but the guys only played it twice, first in London in 2022 as the second of two performances on the same night, and then in Venice in 2023, which actually started in the middle of set A before reaching the same material as London B, which don't forget, by the way, that these set divisions are fan-invented and aren't always neat and tidy. So interestingly, the guys also started performing set C around this same time, which they would stick with for a much longer stretch of the tour. And a lot of set B is just the start of set C, as listener Sunil put it. Set B is great, but it's a weird one because the B sets have so much overlap with A and C, with only two tracks that are B exclusive.
Yeah, so, I mean, starting with high-level thoughts, what do you think about set B overall, having spent, you know, the last 2 weeks just listening to it over and over again?
Yeah, I think, when these first came out, these ones were sort of highlights, and I think it was mostly because they were different, you know, so they immediately stood out. But also, I think these ones are, like, the most, like, normal songs, you know, like... I think you could play this one to somebody who isn't like a huge Ottecker head, but likes electronic music, and I think they would, you know, recognize it as music and listenable, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to sort of discern. Like, do you like that, or do you feel like I can't tell if I'm sensing some disappointment in your voice there?
I think like. The same way when I first got these, and even at the start of this week, I think I liked these a lot more. And then after digging into it, I think that I like these less than set A so far, but I still definitely enjoy them.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think my initial thought here, maybe in a similar way as you, right? Which is like, my initial thought was, this is much more my shit. You know, this is like, we'll talk about it, but much more like hip hop oriented Ottecker. It kind of just like vibes, it grooves, it's steadier. I don't know. I just found myself like really enjoying this a lot more. And yet I can't help wondering, maybe we'll circle back to this, but like by the time I spent a lot of time with it, I was almost feeling like there were maybe less like nooks and crannies to dig into as there were into set A. I don't know. For some reason, I just found myself like revisiting set A toward the end of this like listening period and like kind of having a new appreciation for it. And maybe what I really like is kind of the compliment that set A is really complicated and weird and set B is a little bit more straightforward, and they kind of like bring those qualities out of each other. But there were a couple kind of upfront things that I wanted to mention and get your take on. First is that I feel like set B is a whole lot murkier than set A. It's interesting because like there's more droning and more kind of ambience, and we, I think, described set A as dense a number of times, but I think we meant dense in the sense of like, it's impenetrable. It's kind of hard to get into, but it's not actually so dense, like literally like in a musical sense. In fact, there are a lot of stretches of set A where it's like almost nothing more than a kick and a snare and a hat are going on. You know, they don't sound anything like traditional, you know, drums, but there are really minimal segments of set A, and the really noisy parts of set A, they tend to be like more like particles or artifacts instead of like a consistent droning, you know, over top. Like, do you kind of agree with me on this, that like set B has this kind of murkiness that set A doesn't quite have?
Yeah, definitely. Like when I said dense last time, I meant impenetrable, not spatially dense, whereas I think B is like, you know, foggy, murky, like you said, like there's always like sort of a total thing running underneath it, whereas A has a lot of like emptiness with it's a lot of like emptiness, but you know, tiny bits coming through, you know, around that emptiness, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, I like that word, foggy. You know, it's funny because I also think of this set as being a lot steadier than set A. I mean, set A had all these kind of like, you know, beats that were like lopsided and off balance and kind of bubbly and gurgly. And this feels a lot more like, I don't know, just steady. I was sort of thinking, if there is an overall story that's being told by this larger, you know, 6+ hour composition that they've created, then it's something like a story of, you know, in set A, like a beat kind of, or something struggling to be born. You know, we talked again and again about this, like it's kind of trying to come into being, but it just can't, honestly, like if you think about set A, it almost feels like a bunch of different attempts for something to kind of come into being fully formed and kind of like disintegrating or falling apart at a certain point. I then kind of feel like by the end of set A, you almost get this like ambient kind of cloud, or like this drony kind of cloud settles over everything. And we emerge at the other side of that with something that is much steadier and more solid overall. You know, I think you could get like really cringe with this and read into it like the history of electronic music, you know, kind of coming from noise. And you could honestly get even cringier and read this as like the history of the world, you know, or something.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking like, okay, like the beginning is the Stone Age and then we get into the Bronze Age. I guess I was kind of thinking overall, having listened to this a lot, I feel actually the opposite personally, that like there probably is no grand plan to this. I really think that Sean and Rob like live and breathe the music. They're making tracks all the time. And then when they started putting this together, they just took it piece by piece. Like what would sound good coming next? Like what would sound good coming after that? And so on. And yet just by doing that, you can still kind of, you know, like inevitably what emerges is some kind of like larger picture. Right. So I don't know. What do you kind of think of that? Like, do you think of anything making sense like in the big picture form as far as like how set B kind of builds on or departs from set A or anything like that?
Well, I think we'll get into it more as we go through the tracks, but I feel like this one, you know, there's only a couple things that are exclusive to this B, and so I sort of even just wonder if this is really set B or if this is just, you know, a form in between those two things. You know, so I'm not really sure.
That was another thing I wanted to bring up here, which is like, I mean, the $1 million question here is like, why didn't they do this more? They only did it 2 times. I was talking with somebody like in the Discord today, actually, and they said that on Mastodon, I guess Sean is somewhat active there. He said, somebody asked him that, and he said, I honestly don't know why. Like, I don't know why, you know, like it wasn't like a plan or something. I was wondering, like, did they not like it? Were they not happy with it? It's interesting because we have a listener Joe, who wrote in, and I'll just read his email here, which said, one of the most mystifying things about set B was how little it has been played and how much it overlaps with A and C. Do you guys think that they considered tracks 15 through 20 just completely perfected as well as they could ever really be? Or do you think that they ended up not liking them to the point that they wanted to just move on quickly and forget about them? I was like, initially, my gut was thinking the second, and yet it's a great point that it might have been the very opposite, that they just felt totally happy with it and thought they could move right on. But do you have any like thoughts about the $1 million question? Like, why did they only play this twice?
It's so weird because, you know, like if they only played it the first London one makes sense. They just don't want to play the same thing twice in one night, you know? So I could see like, you know, we make up a little second set, you know, or kind of jam or whatever. But then to play it again in Venice, which is like not the start of the tour or anything, it's right next to the other dates. And then they just go back to play in set C. It's very odd, you know, like that it even is played in Venice. And then when it is played in Venice, you know, it starts so deeply into A, you know. Yeah. I don't know. It's a weird thing, and it makes me like Venice makes it seem like this maybe is B, you know, those extra sections. But I'm just really I can't crack the case.
Yeah, and Vettis B is like honestly the only time that they kind of start at like a random point, you know. Mm-hmm. Most of the other sets, they have a pretty clear start and stop. Now, sometimes they go a little further depending on, I'm guessing, like the mood of the night. There is a point at set C where they start like starting a couple like sort of quote unquote tracks later. I guess they just decided they wanted to skip ahead a little bit of that, but Vettis is the literal only time, which you would think would be kind of like a fundamental feature of this whole project, that they just pick up at a random point and carry on. It just makes it such a strange mystery. I was wondering, and I don't think this totally makes sense, but I couldn't help wondering if like, what if London B, as you say, was just a case of they had to do two shows in the same night, because it's 2022, and they decided to kind of do something different. And then what if it was later that they decided that it would all link together? Now, the problem with that is that Bergen and Athens actually do kind of reach the very beginning of London B. But it sort of makes me wonder if like it just wasn't always the plan that this would be one long continuous thing. And that maybe by the time they got to Vettis, they kind of decided on that. And so they were like, well, let's do a set that kind of shows exactly how this all links up. Do you think that has any merit as a theory?
I mean, yeah. I mean, maybe even they just want to see, you know, for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess maybe, you know, I was going to say, like, maybe it's a little weird if that's, you know, if it's just a test or whatever to release it. But they released, you know, basically the whole tour, except for those couple dates we talked about last time, you know, that there were some issues with.
Yeah. So the other thing I wanted to mention up front, kind of get your take on, is that one of my favorite things about this set is that it caused me to kind of reflect a little bit on like the fine line between rock and hip hop. I was kind of thinking that this set has sometimes very rock like energy and sometimes obviously very hip hop energy, but it just never occurred to me until listening to this over and over again these past 2 weeks that like, it's funny because there's sort of a fine line. I was thinking like there's a certain head nod you do to like Swans versus Wu-Tang Clan. You know what I mean? It's a subtly different feeling, but I was almost thinking like there's a certain amount of menace or a certain amount of heaviness where like that kind of flips, you know, like, and I feel like this whole set is kind of moving back and forth between those two things. And that's kind of why it got me thinking about, you know, it's cringe, but like the history of electronic music, you know, it's like, it's almost like showing the what a fine line different types of electronic music are. Am I sounding insane or do you kind of get what I mean?
I get what you mean. I don't know if that's intentional on their part at all. It may just be, you know, like the function of electronic music, like that just works, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'll have more to say on that as we kind of get further into specific tracks, but I just found that very, very thought-provoking, actually. you know, it's similar to like, I think I sort of mentioned last episode, set A reminds me a lot of times of like Pansonic, one of my favorite artists, yours too, I think. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I like about Pansonic is that they forced me to kind of think about like what music really is. You know, it's really just like malfunctioning machines that people have like turned into, you know, stuff. It's got this kind of like cerebral quality. And I sort of appreciate sometimes this set like gets me all thought, you know, thoughtful about like how music works, where it comes from, all that stuff. I wanted to kind of run through a couple listener comments on just this set overall and just see if anything speaks to you or maybe we want to refer back to it later. But we heard from listener Jackson who said, set B overall feels particularly tactile. It gives me the most sense of impossible objects clanging around some impossible space. One moment in particular feels like a massive water jug glugging bubbles or something. Its overall feel is such a weird mix between swampy, gurgly texture, metallic, glassy sounds, and straight up ethereal prettiness. It's so organic and fluid, like they have total mastery over the live process. I just always love hearing how people like, I mean, it's a struggle for me too, like how to put into words, like what the hell this sounds like. We heard from listener Sunil who said, yes, the scratching is the thing that most obviously screams hip-hop, but the beats are very hip-hop as well. Some of the kick patterns and articulated snare sounds sounds like something you might expect to hear on an old DJ Shadow or DJ Crush record. We heard from listener Josh, who said, "This set really does a good job of showing off everything that makes Autechre who they are, from seemingly formless soundscapes that you could swim in for hours to beats and record scratching you could dance to for hours. They somehow find a way to blend together all their skills and influences into one set here." And finally, listener Joe, who said, that thing I said earlier about the mystifying aspect of, like, did they like this or did they not like this? Either way, why did they play it so few times? Any thoughts kind of come to mind from hearing those overall thoughts from listeners here?
I think, you know, I'll get into a lot of it as we go on. I answer some in my notes.
All right, we'll get into it. So we'll start with tracks 9 through 11, which you'll remember is actually the sort of end, like last third of set A. Why are we starting here? Because Venice starts here. The fan name for this section is called Pryn Kerr. We talked about it last time, but I want to see, like, if it sounds different as an intro here, if we have any new thoughts about it. And I'll start again with some listeners talking about this. Listener Sunil said, "My favorite version of this section is actually on set B, Venice. But this is such a cool segment. It's like an epic jam session." Listener Jackson said, "I prefer the starting point of Venice and feel the first 20 minutes or so of Venice are the strongest version of that material." Listener Joe said, "Track 9 seems to me to be one of the most random places they could have picked to start the set." In contrast here, there's something about the overall flow to the Venice set and also even the versions of the tracks on here that just don't feel quite as hard-hitting and memorable as the London B versions to me. And then listener Mitchell, who said, "When you talked about the bleep bloop part, you missed that it started with a 3-4 polyrhythm that was honestly jaw-dropping when I first listened to it. It's more noticeable if you listen to Venice. My nickname for it is the knife sequence because the metallic shard sounds that follows reminds me of swords clanging in old kung fu movies." Hey, that sounds like Wu-Tang Clan also.
Yeah, there you go.
So, yeah, what are your overall impressions of listening to this again in this very new context?
Yeah, well, you know, I think I kind of liked it as a starting, like Jackson said, but, you know, reading Joe's email too made me think, like, do I like it just because it's different, you know, and like normally I'm, you know, 40-ish minutes into a set by the time I'm hearing this, so like maybe I'm a little, you know, more tired of hearing, you know, all this stuff. So like hearing it start at that, you know, maybe these, it just makes these sounds sound fresh. So I'm really not sure. I like agree with both Jackson and Joe on that. I think like it does sort of seem like a random starting place, but it definitely works. You know, it's that part where it's like that struggling synth, you know, like you talked about in the intro, like that being born. We're still like, that's still sort of happening even this far into set A. And so I think it starts like at a good spot. You get that real, like, just, you know, on the 1-2-3-4, you know, kick drum thing. That's a real, like, I was thinking, like, if you're in the room, like, that would be a pretty hype way to have the set start, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree, because we talked about it last time that this feels like the danciest part of set A. I mean, it's the grooviest part. I love those bloops, you know, that are, yeah, really in almost a traditional way kind of groovy. And of course, yeah, you're right, it starts with like that 4-4 kick. Honestly, it's funny because it's such a hard reset in set A that to me it's a very logical place to kind of start a set. Yeah. And I'm just surprised that they only did it one time. It's almost like they built this in thinking it would be a more common starting point, but they only did it this one time. But yeah, I think what's sort of striking about listening to this again in the context of Venice is that in the set A versions, it tended to be a little bit more gradual. Like, we've got this kind of repeating kick, and then it sort of gets like a bunch of swing added to it. We get like kind of a click kind of adds in, a couple zaps. We get kind of the blooping comes in, and then eventually the clanging. Here, it all kind of crashes in at once. And this is kind of a consistent quality of Venice, I think, which is that they are rushing a little bit, especially this early kind of set A material. Like, they almost can't wait to get into the proper set B. So it all kind of like crashes in at once, which I kind of like, because I don't know if it's like a placebo effect, but it makes it actually hard to separate everything. Like, it all sounds more like coalesced together in sort of a way I like. And maybe that's just because you haven't heard it one by one enter, you know, but I kind of like the way it's all tangled together. And then it follows, you know, the same pattern as we talked about in set A, where eventually that clang kind of drops out and then it gets kind of shoegazier and dronier. One thing that I noticed that, I just like, I don't know, it never like occurred to me before, but there's a loop that kind of comes in toward the end that reminds me of like seagulls, like a sound recording of seagulls kind of going.
Yeah, and I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
It just gets, I think it gets like kind of atmospheric and droney. And honestly, I know it's totally like devised by them, but almost field recording-ish a little bit in that sense. And, you know, overall, I think that's a really fun way to start the track and a cool little arc to kind of lead us from dancey into like the ambient depths a little bit.
Yeah, I think I'm leaning towards I like it as an intro, especially after, you know, I think you articulate it better than I do, and I think I'm gonna lean towards Joe there. Jackson, I'm sorry, Joe.
Yeah, it's Jackson.
Negative.
Yeah, it was funny Jackson, because Jackson. Joe, almost every comment by Joe was like, he really seems to not be a Venice fan, or at least to strongly prefer London to Venice. And I actually agree with him there that I strongly prefer London to Venice for reasons we'll talk about.
Same.
But I do think this is a fun start. All right, so let's move on to the next section, which A.E. Pages calls tracks 12 to 13, and the TTT fan edit calls Aisle 1. Now, this is... only in Venice, of course. We're still only in Venice territory. And some of the set A's, weirdly, stop at about halfway through this, around like at the end of what would be track 12, whereas some others actually continue on through track 13. So we'll talk about this, but first, the only listener we got about this was listener Sunil again, who says, a beautiful ambient piece. It feels very wide open and subtly melancholy. So this is when we kind of talked about like at least half of it in some detail, but what did you think overall of this next section in Venice?
Well, first, I'm glad that this section comes back again here in Venice, because last time I forgot to mention a sound that you talked about, the seagulls and the you know, sort of field recording. Is sometimes there's a cat on this section, and I'll be like, that's 100% just a recording of a cat, and then you'll hear it manipulated and you're like, nah, that's a synth that kind of sounds like a cat, and then I'll hear it again and I'm like, no, it's a cat, and I can never really fully tell. And it sounds a little more synthy, I think, in Venice than some of the other set A's before, but I really like the cat.
Yeah, I haven't heard that, but actually it's funny because my cat is in the room right now and she was just meowing, so I don't know if that got picked up, but that would be a funny time to pick up on the mic. Yeah, we kind of talked last time about the fact that this whole little section feels like a little amorphous, like it just feels like after, you know, kind of a come down from the whole set A. I'm still not totally convinced that the original plan was that this would be like a continuous track, because it very much feels like an outro or something.
Mm-hmm.
This is very like, it's just sort of like the reverb and the echoes kind of running from the end of the previous section. What's cool about it is that we get some kind of like metallic sounds that sort of swell like a church organ or something. Sometimes we get like big, almost like a blast of steam or white noise. There are parts that feel like a big whip crack with like a bunch of reverb on it.
Mm-hmm.
But overall it's very, you know, other than those like kind of explosions of noise, which I think are kind of cool. It just feels like the reverb and the delays and stuff are just kind of continuing to echo on from the previous track. And even the beat, there's like a light beat that continues to run. It's got this kind of heartbeat quality. I mean, it feels to me like just a very subdued version of what was happening at the end of the previous track. I wrote down as kind of a comp here, I think there are parts of this section that make me think of Gas, like Wolfgang Voigt's project, because it's really it's really ambient and the beat sounds like very distant or something like that. But I just don't know if this can really be called like a track, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Same. It has that amorphous, you know, feeling to it. I do love all those like echoes and reverbs that kind of continue forever. It's like when you put like the delay to infinite, you know?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
but I one thing I really appreciate about this and, you know, their mastery is like those delay, you know, reverb feedback things, they're always like threatened to get out of control, but it never goes like fully, you know, feedback or never gets like too loud in the mix, you know? It like it's chaos, but it's completely controlled. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I absolutely know what you mean. And in fact, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but you had found like kind of an interesting interview comment in which they were sort of talking about it feeling like there's a third person in the band, in the sense that they have developed this kind of program that is trying to do its own thing, and they're kind of steering it in a lot of ways. And mm-hmm. I just think like this is an exact case of where you really feel that, because it feels like the beat wants to get going and they are literally holding it back. And I think there's something kind of interesting about that. Like, that's what I mean, is it feels like the beat from the previous sort of quote unquote track, but they are like really trying to rein it in. And I love the sound of like, it sometimes starts kind of going or like escapes a little bit and then they kind of pull it back. I felt this so much when we saw them live, when the outro to the set we saw, this is like a set E in Atlanta. There was like a point where it started like popping off again. And I was like, oh, are we going back? You know, and they kind of like steered it back. So you get the feeling sometimes that there is something like with a bit of a mind of its own that like wants to start running. You know what I mean? I think that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's like one of the central themes of these like sets and stuff, is like controlling that beast or computer, yeah, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so we'll carry on to what A.E. Pages calls tracks 14 and 15, and the TTT fan edit has named M3 Loony. This is the official start of London B, so at this point, Venice and London are now aligned. There is still some set A overlap because there are just a couple, maybe one or two set A's that reach this far. I think actually only Bergen goes all the way to 15. Athens just gets a little bit into 14. So we're starting to get into new territory here. To hear from listener Joe up front here, he says, for me personally, tracks 14 and 15 work way better as the beginning of the London B set than they did as the last two tracks of the Bergen set. As you mentioned, at the end of Bergen, they felt kind of awkwardly out of place there, like an extended outro that didn't really go anywhere. But as an opener to London B, they feel like this exciting hype music for what's going to come next, and builds in this super cool way that almost feels like a sunrise in some epic sci-fi locale. For Venice, they kind of just come and go, as does most of the rest of the set. I just love how you could just tell Joe is like not the biggest fan of Venice. But what did you think of this kind of start of the, you know, set B proper?
Yeah, I like it as a start. You know, it's this real, I'm going to use this word a lot, amorphous. You know, we've got that bubbling coming up. It kind of comes in with like a regular song that, in my notes, I said that it's like threatening to be destroyed again. You know, it's raining, you know, they're always raining that back in. You know, like filter sweeps keep going over it and things like, I don't know. I think that I like this as a start a lot. I'll say, you know, we already mentioned, but London was my preferred of these two. And I really think that this one just like kind of starts at a better spot.
Yeah, I think London is really special, honestly, which we'll start kind of talking about now. But yeah, this track, it's so funny because last episode I compared the end, like the very, very end of the set A's to M4 Lima, the first track of Sign, and clearly the fan who made this also kind of got the same vibe, because they named this section M3 Loony in reference, because it's got this kind of like, you know, things flying past you as you're like kind of floating in space feel. I feel like the Sign album kind of starts in that way. This kind of finds its footing in a similar way. Like there's kind of whooshes and grinding, like kind of flying around your head. But then, yeah, you're right that it's so shocking because it launches into the most traditional quote unquote song of this entire composition so far, where we get a literal actual, it would be so funny to have somebody like listen to this conversation who was like just kind of into normie music, but like we get a literal actual bass note that is playing a note.
Yeah.
And we get this kind of like, it sounds like this like ground up kind of organ sound playing these little three chord patterns. I mean, it's very, very musical all of a sudden. And then of course this very steady, like kind of slow motion hip hop beat comes in. I wrote down a comp to like Wagon Christ, honestly. It is quite grooving and quite musical, but you're exactly right with the second thing you said, which is like after a couple minutes, they start to take it apart and it kind of goes back to being like noise, you know, just warp, almost destroyed versions of that. And yet it stays like steady and it stays mellow and very vibey, you know?
I think that's why, like, I think if you were going to introduce somebody to this, I think London B is kind of a good intro point, because there are so many points throughout it, and especially, you know, it coming at the, you know, you don't have to wait 45 minutes to get to it. You know, it is right at the, you know, first 5-10 minutes. Yeah. Like a real, you know, normal, I kept thinking it was like, if you just showed this to somebody, they would say, yeah, that's a techno song, you know, like,
it's
something that like just your average, you know, man on the street could recognize as music.
Yeah. You know, it's got like kind of a classic IDM feel. I mean, it also kind of reminds me a little bit of like Black Dog or something. Especially because that bass note that kind of drops in, it eventually takes up like kind of a two note pattern. You notice that? Like it kind of goes back and forth. Like we've got like kind of chords underneath. I mean, very musical, very cool, like just very chill. We then kind of move on to the next section here, which the AE Pages calls tracks 16 through 18. And the fan name is Osen PM. This is our first like fully set B exclusive. To hear from a couple listeners about this, we've got listener Josh who says, track 16 is a highlight for me. Kind of emerges as this solid B out of tracks 14, 15 after they've slowly built up from nothingness into a ramshackle of round and bouncy electronic sounds. At some points of this track, I'm reminded a lot of Shim Ripple Casual. It's a lot more rhythmic, but I still feel like I'm floating through space with low-pitched noises breaking through randomly. I'm also a sucker for when a quick percussive noise repeats and sounds like a giant metallic centipede crawling around on the roof of your house. So I love this track for that, too. I just love these, like, the way people try to figure out how to put this in words. Track 17 is really impressive because it brings us from this steady groove we've been sitting in for a while and ramps up the energy without making it feel stressful. By the time we reach track 18, we got there so gradually that I almost forget it didn't always sound this energetic. By the end of this track, I feel like I'm in a Pac-Man arcade machine that's breaking down all around me, and I need to ride the ones and O's to get out. Listener Joe said track 18 is my favorite out of the set B exclusive tracks, and I think captures the overall identity of the set to the extent that it has any identity at all, with this very spacey but still beat-heavy apocalyptic feel. This is also the starkest difference for me in terms of why I prefer London to Venice, because that sawy FM synth sounds so much more sinister and lurking in the London version, whereas in Venice it feels kind of de-sawtoothed to an extent. And finally, listener Jackson, who said the section around 11 minutes into London B is a highlight of the entire comp for me. It sounds like you're getting digested by God. Just love you. But what do you think of this next section?
Well, I really, before I even read Jackson's thing about digestion, it really does kind of sound like eating or something, you know, like there's this gurgling sort of bubbly you know, sort of sound. So I really like the that God is the one doing it. That's pretty great. Also, like in what Josh is talking about, it throughout like every, you know, one's comments like to us and just, you know, things I read and stuff, people always talk about like how these sets feel like so dimensional, you know, like it doesn't just feel like left and right stereo, you know, like it often feels like quadraphonic or something, even though it's not. And I don't have a device to play any of that on. Here we're getting I think it starts with that that slow, like just the bass notes, you know, going back on the like the one and the three, the snare, just riding the two and the four like a real normal normal song. And I'm looking through my notes a little bit. The drum sounds on this are so cool. You know, nothing like really sounds like a normal drum, but like you could place it on the kit, you know, what it's trying to be, but they just sound so like sci-fi and stuff. And then I think throughout this whole section, like there keeps being kind of like these synth sounds that are almost like, you know, sirens or a clarion or something, you know, like in that, like the way they come and go, you know, like in a breathing sort of sense. I think they get more urgent as they go along, but the first one kind of comes in here in I think it's track 17 or 18. My notes I don't write well.
Big like swells, right? Like I wrote down like all over this set, like lots of sounds I would compare to an organ and lots of sounds I would compare to brass, you know, like horns.
That's what I mean. I think clarion, brass.
Yeah, exactly, right? Which is like fitting because these are, you know, these are like instruments that require air to kind of come through. And I feel like there's such a like weird kind of breathing. I mean, you mentioned like the digestive system, but overall this set and especially this section has this kind of like organic quality. I was thinking it is so freaking interesting because for most of my time being an Autechre fan, like back in the day, I would have said that they sounded like a machine, you know, like that's how I always thought of them. And then as we got into closer to modern Autechre, I started thinking they sound like a computer, you know, like this is what it feels like to be a computer. And now we've reached a point where this is what it feels like to be a xenomorph or something. You know what I mean? It's like an actual living, like organic creature. I mean, there's something honestly so phenomenal about the fact that everything is kind of, especially in this section, because in the beginning, like the kind of track 16 section here, it is really quite amorphous. I mean, in the London section, I wrote down like, boy, this is quite a long stall. Like everything is kind of, you know, we're just floating like aimlessly. It's a lot shorter in Venice as a lot of things tend to be actually, but it just sounds like you're lost in like this kind of wet, you know, gurgling, like alien clicking gloop or something. You know, I really imagine that I'm in like an alien movie, like when they come across, you know, the nest where all the eggs are or something like that.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, like you say, like this sounds like organic, but I think if you pick apart like the pieces themselves, like I think most people would describe like each individual sound as an inorganic sound. You know, it doesn't sound like a guitar, a regular bass drum, something, but it's weird how like this, when put all together, it does like bring up a very organic, you know, it's I mean, like you said, alien in the sense like it's otherworldly, you know, like I kept kind of thinking of like you know, like a cyborg or an android, you know, a machine born from, you know, a mix of organic and inorganic. Like it really like feels like that.
Yeah, and it's interesting too because the whole middle, like I think the star of this piece, which is really quite a monster, like it goes on for a good like 15, 20 minutes or something, is this weird kind of shuffling drum pattern that gets like really repetitive. It reminds me, God, I should have written down, but almost like, I mean, it reminds me of like certain Burial tracks. In fact, there was a listener who had recommended that we talk about the Kindred EP. And so I was kind of listening to that just to refresh my memory. And the Kindred EP has like a similar kind of shuffling pattern, but there's also there's this especially kind of demonic sounding Boards of Canada track that has this like repeating kind of like drum shuffle. I'm sure it'll come to me in a minute. But the reason it made me think of Burial is because of course, Burial's whole thing is like, he hand places all of his drums, you know, he sort of like actually draws them into his DAW so that they have kind of an organic, like imperfect quality. And I think that that is another aspect of this. And honestly, this whole project, that everything kind of has this like almost hand placed you know, like rough, imperfect, you know, sometimes things are offbeat or like unquantized or things. So this kind of cool, like shuffling pattern that it's like metallic. I wrote down that in Venice, it sounds particularly digital. Like it actually has kind of like a low bit rate, like kind of a bit crushed quality to it, but it still has this like organic feel, and it repeats and repeats and builds in intensity over the track, I think in a very like Swans-like way. I also wrote down as some other comps, that first part that is especially kind of amorphous and weird, really reminds me of one of my favorite albums, Future Sound of London's Lifeforms album. It's got this kind of digital jungle feel. And then also there were parts, especially on Venice, that reminded me of Global Communications, because the kind of snare has this like almost ticking clock kind of a feeling, but also just that general kind of oozing ambience. Yeah, I mean, what a monster of a track. I think it starts off in kind of this weird digital jungle. Eventually the shuffle comes in. It builds an intensity over and over again in like a very repetitive, like kind of Swans-like way. And by the end, we start to get, like I wrote down straight up like Sun-esque droning and feedbacking, you know, like real good distortion in the middle of there. This is what I meant when I said like there are parts of this that feel very rock to me, you know?
Yeah, rock like Sun Rock.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get you. No, I wrote here, like, it feels, again, like we're taming this beast, you know? Like, it's riding the edge of ambience and, like, just full-on, you know, white noise wall or something. You know, like, it's again, just threatening to go out of control, but never fully ever does, you know?
Yeah. So then I kind of think on that note, though, that it does kind of get out of control when we get to the next section, which is tracks 19 through 20. The fan name for this is Now.1. This is another Set B exclusive. And I'll read a couple of listeners' thoughts on this to kind of get them on the record and start us off. Listener Mitchell says, Set B is more of the same, like an extension of Set A's sonic explorations until track 21, so it's right after this. With London B and Venice, this section is more of a little something extra than a full-fledged new set. So he's kind of saying, like, before we get there, this feels like a little something extra still of Set A. Listener Joe wrote to say track 20 sounds very cool, but it's the moment in the London set where it feels the most like they've run out of steam and are kind of just spinning their wheels up until the very end of the track when it starts building and getting ready to transition into track 21, which is an obvious highlight and a super obvious place to begin set C to my ears. It sounds so much like the whole stream of music, which has been idling for a while, just gets rejuvenated and restarted here, and you feel like this is going to lead somewhere amazing. So I thought it was interesting that listeners in general seem to feel like this is less interesting on its own and more of just like the last thing before we get to one of the true highlights of this set. Do you kind of agree, like, or do you feel like this is kind of an interesting piece on its own?
No, I totally agree. You know, this feels like the most like sort of, I don't want to say jammy, but like, you know, are they just one of the listeners I think said like spinning their wheels, you know, like is this really Set B, or is this just, you know, kind of padding out, jamming to get to these other sections? You know, it seems like at this point, like, you know, C has maybe already been worked on or something, as you know, as we get to it. So like, I wonder, like, are these, you know, B exclusive things really just kind of a means to an end?
Yeah, I could totally see that. And I think this is, you know, in London, I think it works quite nicely, as I was kind of alluding to before, as like a crescendo to the long buildup that was the previous section, because you basically get this clang kind of comes in that is going kind of double time, like on every beat. Mm-hmm. And it just makes it feel like the whole track, like, kind of, you know, lurches forward into like double speed. You know, it's very exciting, it's very thrilling. All of the pieces, honestly, of the previous section, the Os and PM section, they kind of continue, but they just start getting like destroyed and twisted and distorted. And eventually we kind of hit like what I sort of wrote down in my notes. It feels like almost a free jazz freak out. And in that respect, it's got a nice kind of just like a crescendo to the previous thing. Now, I will say that in Venice, I think this track is like a disaster. I think it like completely falls apart. I almost feel like this is what Joe is referring to, because it's sort of just like collapses. Like it runs out of all steam. It runs out of all oomph. And it's like, they keep trying to like achieve liftoff. This is the one moment in this whole project that I feel like I can literally hear Sean and Rob fighting against the program they've made and it not cooperating. Is that too harsh?
I don't think it's too harsh, you know, when we're looking in so like tightly on these sets, you know. Yeah. I and like I alluded to at the beginning of the episode, you know, when I first got into these sets and everything, like I really kind of liked London B and Venice, you know, for being different and everything. But I think like as you look more, you know, granular into it, you know, Venice does have a lot of flaws, and that is one of them. You know, like this section kind of goes off the rails a little bit. I just feel like this whole like kind of chunk, this like really the chunk that's getting us from A to C, it is really like it's one of the hardest points to tell, like, okay, I definitely agree with the track, you know, split on AE pages or even on the yeah. TTT, you know, like these ones seem more like, you know, like, okay, when I listen, I could hear, you know, something changes at that point, you know, but like, I think you even mentioned like a lot of the percussion sounds, a lot of the sounds from that previous section are like continuing here. Yeah. It just sort of like, I don't know, this whole like little bit, like it really feels like extended outro or extended, you know, whatever you would call it in the middle.
Yeah. And I swear to God, like, you know, Dan, you and I used to be in a band and like an experimental band, and we like to play with, you know, pedals and effects and mess with things. And there were definitely times where I felt like pissed off because we kind of like lost control of the thing and couldn't get it to do what we wanted to. And on a personal level, I almost relate to this section, or, you know, maybe it's just me reading into it, but it sounds to me like one of those annoying moments when it won't do what you want it to do.
Totally.
But we'll move on to, you know, brighter pastures here, which is AE Pages calls this tracks 21 through 23. The fan name is Corsine. This is the official start of set C. And yet I want to be very clear that we are only talking about the set B versions of this, because I think it may be a little different. Of course, we'll come back. We'll talk again about this when we talk about set C next time. But we're only talking about, you know, the London and Venice versions of this. To read a couple things up front, we have a footnote here from AE Pages, which says, of course, this has scratching in it. One sample that gets scratched in this segment is the It's Time to Change sample from Jan and Dean's A Stench in Time. It should be noted that the same sample is present in Chris the Glove Taylor's Ichiban Scratch, which appeared in multiple of Autechre's mixes, including 2015's Deckmantle mix. And now we have a number of write-ins from listeners on this quite striking part of the set. Listener Sunil says, I see a distinct shift at Corsine, where the character of the AE Live changes from primordial abstractedness of set A into the more warm, spacious material of set C. Aisle 1, which was kind of a ways away through Now 1, which is the thing we were just talking about, serves as the bridge, being set A-like, but more stripped down and minimal. The way the jet stream of noise that is Now 1 descends into Corsine is a really beautiful moment in the project. Listener Mitchell said, the biggest change in their sound in this era is how they're now into spectral processing. This is more significant than whatever gen wizardry Sean described in the Twitch AMAs. It adds to the live sets a liquid timbre that sounds either like water field recordings or shitty MP3 compression. Definitely a clear break from the Sine Plus era. I want to read that here because I think that is especially pertinent here, as I'll talk about in a minute. Listener Josh said, Another obvious highlight is the end of track 22 when they start messing around with the record scratching. It really is that good every time. It's ethereal and makes me feel like I might start levitating at any given moment. Imagine being in the room for the first B set and hearing Autechre start scratching. It would be like if the Beatles got on the roof and started playing A Hard Day's Night. Like, wow, they're still really good at that too. I also feel like the pitched metallic hits during this part remind me of C16 Deep Thread from LSEC. Listener Joe says the turntable scratching in track 22 is one of my favorite Autechre music moments ever, and track 22 in general is probably the first track from the whole live set so far that sounds like something they legitimately haven't done before. Obviously, all of 2022 Dash sounds new and fresh, but it's all had parallels in their other post-2013 work in terms of sounds and compositions. This almost sounds like AE's take on Returnal / Replica era OPN, and the frenetic hip-hop beat and scratching over the emotional FM synths is something that probably only AE would be able to pull off in this way without sounding totally ridiculous. Finally, we got listener Jackson, who says, the hip-hop part is obviously incredible, but it's hard to say it really belongs to set B. That section has so much variety across performances, and it's endlessly groovy. I don't know how there are so many sounds living in that section. Feels like twice as many distinct noises live there than is normal for a track in these sets. So, a lot of excitement, a lot of enthusiasm about this part. What do you think of it?
Yeah, I mean, this is the clear, you know, at least beginning of a highlight for London and Venice, but you know, you've got like the most hip hop sounds, you know, all kind of start here. Obviously we got DJ scratching, which I really want to know, how are they doing that? You know, like I know how people DJ scratch, but like
they didn't bring a turntable, right?
No, like, because
they're doing it digitally.
Even in these more like recent AMAs, someone asked like what MIDI controller they're using, and I forget what it was called. I didn't write it down, but it's just a, you know, thing with a handful of knobs on it. Nothing to record scratch on. So I was really it's not pre-recorded because it's different a little bit, you know, in Venice, mm-hmm. you know, it's not the exact same thing. I spent so much time like wondering like, how the hell, like, what are they doing that with?
Yeah. I mean, definitely like, yeah, it's got, you sort of get like these kind of echoes and reverberations again from the previous track, and it almost sounds like the memory or something of the last track, mm-hmm. and then in crashes in this very deep like hip-hop groove. I mean, very East Coast hip-hop, very RZA style, like that kind of dirty, murky basement, like kind of East Coast hip-hop quality. Of course, there's a part before where you get a little like, I kind of compared it to like a clav or something. Like there's a little bit of funkiness, like that kind of reminds me of Stevie Wonder or something. There are little organ stabs that remind me of like, I don't know, the Meters. I just, everything is reminding me of like the kind of shit you would sample in a hip hop mm-hmm. track or something.
Exactly.
Then we get what I wrote down as like a trash can solo, you know, these kind of like big booming, like a plastic type trash can. And it's funny because this is why I wanted to read, who was it? It was Mitchell's. Email about like spectral processing and stuff like that, because it's just funny, because could you record a like you beating on a trash can and probably get like a similar sound? Yes, I think. But first off, it's amazing that they sort of designed this, like it sounds so much like a three-dimensional object that they have designed just in audio, you know. I think that's incredible. And then also, of course, you wouldn't be able to have a trash can like evolve over the course of a track the way that they are. So I find that really interesting. And then of course the scratching comes in, but I came to feel like the scratching is almost a distraction, or it can be, from everything that's going on underneath, which is like honestly incredible. It is really musical. There are like, I think what I sort of wrote down in London as like low piano notes underneath. And in Venice, this is one thing I really like about Venice. It sounds a little bit more like really deep church bells or something kind of ringing underneath, but you get these kind of like high strings join in, this kind of like, there's like a ghostly kind of a lead sound in the distance. I don't know. Next time you listen to this, like if you listen underneath, I'm sure a lot of people have, but you listen underneath the scratching, which can kind of dazzle you a little bit. It's kind of like the prettiest thing of this whole composition so far. And I just find it such an interesting combination. I mean, I wonder, I don't know if you kind of said it directly, but like, do you find the scratching, like it almost like it feels out of place, or do you love it, or like what?
I don't think it feels out of place, but I was thinking, you know, like if you're, you know, these were originally live concerts. So if you're in the room, I think, you know, you're obviously going to like focus heavily on the scratching because it's the, mm-hmm. you know, most upfront, obvious thing. But, you know, like, is that like, you know, why releasing these is so good? Because they do reward deep listening? Or is that like a using the live concert incorrectly, you know, sort of thing? Mm. I'm not really sure, but this section in particular, I think rewards multiple listens, deep listenings, because you're right, there's so much like other little things that I think you lose in that it becomes like a normal song, and so that you stop like noticing, you know, the weird trash can noises and whatnot.
Yeah, I think that I honestly feel like two things simultaneously, which is that I love the scratching. One, not despite the fact, but because of the fact that it is kind of a MacGuffin. Like, I think it sort of distracts you from what is really special about this track, which is like all the shit going on underneath, which I just am obsessed with. But at the same time, I think that it adds a lot of depth to this track. I especially love the way that they very, very slowly fade the scratching, because it sounds like there is just infinite depth to this. You know what I mean? Like how it like really slowly fades out. You can still hear it mm-hmm. scratching like minutes and minutes later, like really deep in there. It just makes this sound so vertical. And honestly, like almost counterintuitively, if it's a distraction at first, it sort of like draws your ear to listen more closely because it starts fading. And as you try to like stretch to listen, you might actually start to notice all that like fascinating stuff. I ended up just deciding, like, you know, on first listen, I was like, oh, that's fun, but maybe gimmicky. But then I started thinking like, this is so brilliant because it like how it plays with you as a listener a little bit.
Yeah. You know, that meme that's like the graph, it's like, you know, dumb person, medium, and
yeah,
smart,
yeah, yeah.
And you know, they agree. It does that, you know.
Yes, exactly. That's great. Yeah, yeah. You know, the other thing about this, I think, is that by the end we get some real beaming, like brass-like sounds. I compared it to like a bugle call, and I think you were kind of alluding to this earlier when we were talking up front. But like these big, like beaming kind of sounds that I just think are so like spectacular. And are really just like kind of a highlight for me as it kind of fades. And then we move into the last section here, which is tracks 24 through 25 per AE pages and has the fan name of Drain 3. This is the end of both set Bs, or all set Bs then, I guess. It is sometimes or very often the start of set C a little bit later on. So for a number of set C's, they kind of start, we'll talk about this next time, they start at core scene, but then they eventually start kind of skipping that and starting here. A couple things to mention up front. We got a note from AE Pages, which again, there's some scratching here, and it notes that a sample used in this segment is Besides, that's the artist name, Besides, Change the Beat, specifically the famous Fresh sample. And then we got some write-ins from listeners, like listener Joe, who says, it's strange to hear tracks 24 and 25 as the outro here, because I remember them so distinctively as the opening to the concert I attended in Riga, which since hearing it, it's the one part of that show that's been vividly stuck in my head and has become one of my favorite Autechre tracks or stretches of music they've ever made. I'm honored to have heard it in person because it's apparently the last time they ever played it. I think it's fascinating because it works perfectly as both a set intro and a set outro. Not as well in Venice, because the Venice one in general just isn't as good. There's Joe again, not, you know, trashing on Venice. But no, we got to talk about that. We'll talk about that next time. But yeah, the weird fact that this serves as both an outro here and then an intro to some other pieces. And then we got listener Josh, who said, hearing that same drain bouncing ball effect in track 25 is so cool. And then you add the scratching sounds over it and start to wonder what decade of Autechre you're even listening to anymore at this point. It's moments like these that remind me how much of a treasure trove these live sets are to go through. So what do you think of this kind of conclusion?
Yeah, I think what Josh said's really good. You know, wondering what decade you're listening to. I think it shows, you know, some people like complain, you know, they like the old Autechre, you know, kind mm-hmm. of stuff, and they don't like this, you know, more inhuman, but it really shows you that like they've they've not lost that, you know, ability. It's this is a little cringe, but it's very like an artistic thing, you know, like Picasso. He said, you know, it took him decades to learn to paint like a child, you know, like it's that same sort of thing. It's like they can still like make normal, quote, you know, doing air quotes here, music while still making these like insane computer, you know, like, you know, mind-blowing things. And to be able to like meld those two is really impressive. So I think that this section, it's a shame that it's like not played as often, but
yeah,
it is really good as far as like the sounds themselves. Like I really like, there's like a few times like these big like synth bass like bombs come dropping in, and it really gives it like that 3D like feeling, you know, because I think in like, you know, maybe a lesser band or something, when they do those like sort of bomb things, it's all like just you know, it's an easy trick like to hype the audience or something, but here it's like it's not that at all, you know, like it again, it's like still controlled, and like it's just another, it's like it's a sound more to like create that space than to just, you know, be a like a jump scare kind of thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, like this big low bass note starts hitting like on the one pretty much every time, and it kind of like hangs over the rest of the pattern, and it sounds like downright evil. I mean, it sounds absolutely menacing.
Yeah.
And this is what I meant about like when I was saying that we were kind of like in hip hop territory, and then I just sort of realized that it got a little too evil, and all of a sudden we're back in rock territory. Like there's some weird like fine line there where like, okay, a little bit evil, it's Wu-Tang Clan. A little more evil than that, it's Swans now. You know, like that was just kind of how it feels. And I especially like, I was thinking like, how the hell do you program a sound like this? But it's like a low droning kind of distorted bass note that starts to feed back, you know, it actually starts to feed back like you would expect a guitar to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And basically you have this really steady, heavy kind of, you know, hip hop type drum pattern, this really menacing kind of like these bass bombs. You have eventually kind of the scratching comes back. And what I also notice is that every time the drum pattern, like it'll sound really heavy. It sounds a little bit more rock to my ears. And then it'll kind of tighten up and get a little bit crisper and clackier. And then all of a sudden it's like back to hip hop, you know, the kind of like the knife's edge there. I was honestly thinking like, this might be the first Autechre rap rock / nu metal song that they've ever done. And I mean that as a compliment, but the, you know, that kind of like just the droney quality of this, there are parts where I was writing down like, boy, this really makes me think of like a sitar kind of droning, you know, over this thing. I mean, I think it's such a menacing and climactic conclusion. Also, shout out to the fact, I mean, this kind of adds like a nice symmetry to the London set in particular. Eventually those kind of low bass notes end up forming another back and forth, like two note pattern. Like they go up and they come back down, and reminds me of like that two note pattern that we kind of started the London set with, something kind of musical, but I just love it. I mean, I really look forward to like really digging into set C, because I almost have a hard time really appreciating this as a theoretical intro, because it just sounds like such an evil, like chilling ending. I just love it.
Yeah. Same. I purposely didn't go ahead and listen to set C. You know, I've heard them when the sets first came out, but like I really was tempted, especially because only doing two sets, I kind of got sick of listening to these two, if I'm being honest. But
well, that's why I went back to set A. I started to miss set A.
See,
against my,
I did too, but the same way, I was like, no, I gotta focus. I've shifted into set A mode. I gotta keep it on B. And so I purposely didn't listen to any of the other ones. But yeah, this set here, I'm really like curious to like, now that it's downloaded in my brain, to hear how it is as an intro, because yeah, I think it's just such a like masterful outro here.
Yeah, well, on that note, we got a couple more emails from listeners, which I kind of stuck here because they felt like they were describing the end of the set, but like the end of the set as like in a bigger picture way. And I've got some more listener emails that are more like wrapping up stuff. But first, we got this message from listener Rob, who said, I'd been listening to the London show on Sennheiser over-ear headphones. And as good as these are, it was once I played the show over speakers that it took on a whole new dimension. I'm a teacher and was in an empty classroom that has an interactive whiteboard with good speakers. I put on the show via YouTube and set the volume fairly high. It was incredible. The way the sound filled the room, even with shitty YouTube quality, was fantastic. Specifically, there is a tone that played at 47 minutes. That's right in the middle of the piece we're sort of talking about. That pierces my eardrum, figuratively, and then settles in my jawbone where it vibrates for the next 20 seconds. This wasn't the experience I had with the earphones. I wonder if either of you have tried listening to the live show over speakers and how this compares to earphones. I'm beginning to wonder if these shows have to be listened to loud over speakers to get the full experience. And then we heard from listener Jackson, who I think was maybe on the same note, maybe or not, but who said, hoping you will mention that one part in London B and the climactic part toward the end, the one that feels like you're just totally ascending as the synths just wail into the void. So I think both listeners here are sort of alluding to like these big sort of explosions and swells of feedback that kind of happen at this like climactic ending here, which I agree are absolutely stellar. I mean, do you have any thoughts in general about that idea of like, do these sets work on headphones? Must they be listened to in like a big PA system or what?
Well, I think like listener Rob wrote it. I think the I think they wrote them to be listened to on a smart board through YouTube.
Yeah, definitely.
that seems the optimal way. I don't know. I do most of my listening in headphones. Really, with just all music, I kind of prefer it. I did listen to both of these sets on my speakers pretty loud. Both of these sets are really all odd ticker. Really kind of bothers my dogs and makes them bark
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, yeah. My cats can't.
Yeah. Stand. Yeah, yeah. There was like a couple like knocking kind of noises, and my wife was gone with her sister, and so the dogs are like waiting for her to come home, and every time one of these like knock sounds would go, they would go ape shit barking and stuff. So so not the optimal way to listen. I mean, there definitely is like a physicality that, you know, gets lost in headphones, I think with almost all music. But I like the headphone portion of listening to these AE sets, because you could really like feel that space, especially on over the ear headphones. Like you're directly in the middle, and it's so easy for me, at least, like to put myself in that, like, you know, 3D space that they've created when I'm on headphones.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say first off, I'm a teacher also, and I have done this as well, although not really loud because I'm worried people will hear, but I've done like sort of optional, you know, like one-on-one days, and of course no students show up, you know, when it's optional, so I'm just like listening to music in the classroom, like working on something. So I have done that, but it's funny because the whole original run of this podcast, I was fully headphones. I lived in like a little apartment. And now I think I mentioned that I have like kind of a nice speaker setup in my current home, and I'm kind of all speakers. And, you know, since seeing Autechre live, it's sort of like clicked for me. I think the way that some of these sounds are supposed to feel like they're kind of flying around the room. I used to think of them as like flying around my head, you know, which mm-hmm. I guess is the same difference. But when seeing it live, it just really had this impression of like literally bouncing off the walls, which I thought was a really cool effect. And so now I just feel like, I don't know, I changed the way almost that I'm listening to them, and I'm really enjoying actually, I mean, I'm excited for as we continue kind of this rebooted podcast, like maybe revisiting some stuff, because I want to get that experience of like the speaker version rather than the headphone version, just because seeing them live kind of made me curious about how that works. But yeah, I think that like there, well, actually there's another comment a little bit later on, so I'll save it. But there's a comment where somebody had said, kind of describing something that they were, that they heard in one of these sets as like almost like a 3D shape. And I think that for me kind of becomes clear on speakers for some reason, like you can feel these shapes in the room or something, but I'll kind of save that. So, At this point, oh yeah, we had one more kind of email that was just sort of wrapping up this last track. Listener Sunil said, London has more raw energy and is less developed, while Venice is more polished and serene. I'd also say London feels more set A-like than Venice, despite having less set A overlap. Overall, I prefer Venice. The Pryn Kerr start is just awesome, and I think Venice outdoes London B in most of their shared sections, especially core scene. However, Drain 3, the very end here, is an exception where London B's raw energy really shines and just knocks it out of the park. As we kind of transition into like going back to the high-level thoughts, yeah, any sort of thoughts on the contrast between the two sets here?
Yeah, I think I alluded to this, but coming into it, I think like the first time I, not literally, but sat down to listen to these sets, you know, for this podcast, I think I was like, oh, Venice is the one, you know, this is the one I'm going to like more. And I even, like I was listening to it over and over and stuff. And I really kind of, as I looked more like granular at it, I saw the kind of flaws in it. And then I really started to like London B more. And I think it's sort of like Sunil mentioned a bit, you know, like this one, it's got that raw energy. It doesn't feel as like polished and whatnot. And we don't get that a lot with Ottekker. And I think it's, you know, because of the moment, you know, like them playing a second set, you know, in the night. So it's sort of like B, I think, is like this more of a kind of raw gem that doesn't like exist everywhere in the Ottekker catalog.
Yeah, I think I agree. Like in a way, I agree with Sunil, and yet I end up concluding the opposite, which is that I like that, like you, that kind of like rawness, that raw energy to London. I think Venice feels a little overworked. Like it rushes through some sections that are my favorite, like especially that kind of opening section. What was it called? The well, not the opening, but the opening of both of them, M3 Loony, which has just that like awesome groove and that very musical kind of like organ pattern we talked about. It kind of rushes through that and like destroys it as quickly as possible. Like it goes back to being like just kind of messed up noise. And I think that's honestly kind of a shame. There are other parts that I think are like that Now One section, which kind of like misfires a little bit. Honestly, in that respect, I feel almost opposite of Sunil, which is that Venice reminds me more of set A, and that it is like often tangled and twisted and off balance, you know, whereas London B is like rock steady, you know, it vibes, it just goes, and you can kind of like nod your head to almost the whole thing. And yeah, I kind of like that almost, I don't know, that like it's got like almost a demo energy to it, and like a rawness, which is just like it's simpler.
What I was thinking like if I was at one of these shows, London B seems like the most fun show to be at of the sets we've listened to so far because of that, you know, and that was like an exciting thing, especially, you know, most people, I guess, aren't listening this way, but like in doing this podcast and listening to them over and over and stuff, like the, you know, London B is a bit of like kind of fresh air in that.
Yeah. And let me be clear that even though I have mixed feelings about Venice, I would still sacrifice my firstborn child to have been there. And I don't have kids,
same.
So I can just say that. But if I did, I'm sure they wouldn't mind me saying it.
No.
So to kind of start to conclude here, we've got a few more listener emails that I want to kind of rapid fire through. But first, like zooming back out to high level thoughts, I wonder if there's any change in your kind of overall impression now that we've talked about it piece by piece. Any kind of thoughts on like the project overall, which we also kind of talked about briefly at the beginning. But I think the most important question I want to know at this point is like, do you feel like set B has its own identity, or is it just more of like an in-between between sets A and set C? It's interesting because we both kind of agree, I think, that the weakest, more or less, like the weakest parts of this are the B exclusive parts. So is there any like reason to even listen to set B, or should you just do set A or set C?
I mean, if you're not going to listen to all the concerts, you know, if you're not going to listen to this whole set, I think that if you're going to skip any, these are some, or at least Venice. I think Venice is skippable. London B is, you know, nice in
special.
The way
it's special.
Yeah, it's special. It's special, exactly. But I really don't think that I'm not fully convinced that set B is actually a set B. You know, I don't know that it's not just kind of a way they got to see parts, you know, twice, you know, during tours. It doesn't have like this set identity like A did, you know, like last episode when we were, you know, really digging into those, like I could really tell like, okay, this is a track. And then I could hear that repeated again, you know, the next concert, just in a, you know, in a jazz sort of way, which I think I said, you know, where it's like, it's the same song, maybe not played the same way, but it's the same song. You know, that happens here in this little interstitial portion, but that interstitial like just seems so interstitial, you know, it's like a bridge just getting us there. I don't know, I mean, maybe it'll change as I dig into set C and see how it you know is different, but right now I don't see B like as totally independent and totally its own thing.
Yeah, I really have mixed feelings, because as I thought about it, I was like, honestly, wondering, like, does set A even have a strong identity? I mean, we talked last time about the fact that it doesn't feel like it grows or builds anywhere. It just feels like a series of pieces kind of stitched together almost at random. Actually, I kind of think set B is similar, except for it's a lot fewer pieces that are a lot longer and like you spend a lot more time in them. So it doesn't feel so fragmented and fractured. Now, like I said at the beginning, I honestly feel like one of the points of set A is to be like a series of aborted attempts to like take off. You know, it almost has this quality of like something slowly comes into being and then it like disintegrates and falls apart. You know, that's almost like the nature of the thing. And I think that's cool. But in a way, set B is like more successful than set A because it achieves that liftoff. You know, it actually is like more pleasant to listen to. Now, I have mixed feelings about Venice, but I think that everything I'm talking about, it is much better represented in London B. And I think London B is like kind of a must hear, like a special thing. Now, I know that some people feel the opposite. I know that some people definitely like prefer Venice, you know, to each their own. And actually, I think like the funny thing about this whole project, honestly, is that no two listens are the same. You know, sometimes that's literally true because you're listening to a different set and it actually was played a little bit differently. But also sometimes you're listening to the same set again, and just because of the way this is designed, like in such a complex way, you're always hearing new things you didn't hear before. So I don't know. In that respect, it's like, obviously it's fun to have both and jump back and forth between both. And so in that respect, it's like, okay, if London is worth listening to, well, then obviously it's worth also checking out Venice because it's another version of the thing you like, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it has an identity. Maybe we can answer this question a little bit better when we get to set C, and maybe we'll decide, you know, actually that stuff that was the last half of set B, that's really just the beginning of set C, you know? But we'll kind of circle back to that conversation. At this point, I got one last list of kind of overall or maybe just tangentially related listener emails to wrap us up here. And we'll do these maybe like a little bit, you know, rapid fire style. We don't have to spend as much time breaking them down. But I want to start with listener Mitchell, who said, as for your comments about AI music, Autechre should be fine because they use their machines as an extension of their compositional practice instead of a replacement. I don't think the rig is like Suno or Udio. I don't know what the hell those are. Rather, it's only generating sounds from two sources, Rob Brown and Sean Booth. If anything, the rig having baked in parameters is what makes Autechre sound like Autechre and not a simulacrum of the top 20. That's a funny idea that like AI would try to make you sound like a top 20 artist if it had a mind of its own. It was at this point that I wondered, Dan, like you kind of were sending me these comments that I alluded to earlier about like them feeling like there's a third person. Can you just kind of summarize that like conversation?
Yeah, as Sean says that like it feels like gaming, that in the sense that there's AI in it, that he says it's only if statements, conditionals, if the situation is this, then do that type of things. He says it's, he calls it as basic as a game AI. And they say that, like, they're basically wanting to break the game. Rob says, like, you know, making a car float or, you know, or be transparent. You know, like when you, it made me think of like Grand Theft Auto or something. Like when you get to a or Pokemon, you know, like in, you know, Missing No, the whole thing, like breaking the game and like the game itself, like the coding of the game, not like cheating. And I think that like makes a lot of sense when you listen to this. And, you know, we talk about like, you know, this taming the beast and like it getting away from them and stuff like that often feels like those sorts of things in, you know, in a video game hacking kind of way.
Yeah, like they basically created a really elaborate sandbox and now they are kind of playing in it and trying to break it, as you said. I think a lot of times they are trying to like, yeah, reel it back in the sense of like get it to do something that it's not supposed to do or something like that. Yeah. And like get it to do that anyway. That's, you know, that comment about the car floating. So yeah, I mean, I just wanted to read this because I love what Mitchell said about it's an extension, not a replacement of their compositional practice. Yeah, I can totally hear that, but I do think like some of the fun and then in the very rare instance of like that one track, the Nal.1 of the Venice set, both the fun and the sometimes downside of it is that you can sometimes hear them fighting with the thing, right? Sometimes that's really interesting to hear, sometimes less so. Here's another kind of a longer message from Dave, but I wanted to read it because it was on the kind of famous Helsinki debacle, which we didn't touch on last time, and I think it's important we do. So this is what Dave writes about his experience seeing Autechre in Helsinki in 22. I dragged my wife, who, to put it charitably, is not Autechre's biggest fan, to Helsinki to see them at Musiikkitalo, some venue that name that I can't pronounce, which is a legit all-seated concert hall with incredible world-renowned acoustics. I think it's the same place that the kind of very famous like 2016/2018 set was done. Because of the venue, it felt like a fairly formal experience, if that makes sense. I think it's a fantastic set. It was the most immersive thing I had ever heard, and there was some weird stuff going on where the sound felt almost three-dimensional, sculptural even. At one point, at around 20 minutes in, there's a section with some tumbling metallic tones, and I don't know how, because they don't work in surround sound, only stereo, but these seem to be coming directly from the center of the hall, moving upwards in a column. This is what I meant when I was saying that, like, there are certain kind of shapes that you hear when you're listening to this on, like, big speakers. It was quite extraordinary, some psychoacoustic magic or something going on there. Unfortunately, at around the 40-minute mark, there were some audio issues, and the sound system started making some fairly loud noises, which I can best describe as being like a whip cracking. I thought it was part of the set at first, but a rather frantic sound guy appeared at the stage, and the lads were clearly not having a good time. This carried on until the end of the set, but in spite of this technical goof, it was pretty incredible, and I had a good time. They sent the soundboard over a week or so later by way of an apology, which was a nice touch. I forgot about this. You remember this, Dan, that like they released kind of an unmastered just version of Helsinki, like very early because it was sort of an apology for this.
Yeah. Yeah. I did sort of forget about that. We should circle back around to that.
Yeah. So he continues, they were obviously quite bothered by this. I felt that certainly Rob looked quite disappointed when they walked off stage. My wife, by the way, said afterwards that it was the worst thing she had ever been to. Not just the worst concert, but the worst thing. There's no accounting for taste, is there? I love this. There's just like a quality that like all wives and girlfriends just hate this. But how would we know if they're the one unless they agreed to come with us to these Autechre concerts?
Yeah, exactly. It's a rite of passage.
Yes. Anyway, any thoughts about that? Love hearing Dave's experience here.
Yeah, I remember in the AMA, the other show that messed up, Sean said that he accidentally unplugged his mixer, and that's why it there was a big problem. But I don't think that's what it was in Helsinki.
Yeah, I mean, interesting, right, to hear. It's interesting that, I don't know, if they weren't having a good time, then why did they end up releasing it on the set? Is it because they already went ahead and released it anyway, or were they, despite all of this, still happy with how it ended up? I'm just not sure. I also am very interested in the fact that the thing that I ultimately do not like, and I maybe want to give this another shot, but that I just decided I don't really like that much about the 16-18 sets, is that they are designed specifically for, it seems like, seated concert halls. It's kind of that like formal experience. And I have sort of been conceptualizing the 2022 Dash project as an attempt to, like, in an all-techery way, get back to the dance floor. So I am kind of interested to hear that they did kind of seek out, they seem to like this venue because they play it pretty regularly, but just interesting to imagine, like, how different this set might be in a seated situation, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it a bit when we saw A just recently, you know, I at that time, like, I had only kind of briefly listened to these 2022 Dash things, and I came into it kind of expecting that sit down, even I knew the venue wasn't seated, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And was a little surprised to not have that.
Well, here's another related listener email from Ian, who says, I was thinking about how seeing them is very much down to the luck of the draw. You could see them and get the really difficult Athens or Milan shows, or by luck, see the Lisbon show, and I'd imagine have a much more enjoyable evening. I guess that's just how improvised music goes. But yeah. Like I said earlier, I would still, you know, cut my arm off to be able to see even their worst show, honestly, because I love this shit regardless.
Yeah, and I think too, like, you know, when we are listening to these over and over, when you're in the moment, I feel like you never are like, oh man, that sucked. That was you know, we got a difficult Athens. You know, like, you're gonna come out being like, oh, that ruled. You know, it's just nerds like us that are listening to it 100 times. You know, so I definitely would see them any time they were, you know, within traveling distance to me.
Yeah, and it's still, like, so good. It's like, you know, if you saw the worst, you know, Grateful Dead show in 1977, you still saw one of the best
shows exactly.
ever, you know.
Exactly.
All right, here's another one from listener Mitchell, who says, Set A is my least listened to batch of live sets. Have to agree that it does meander like 16/18, but with the structure of 14/15 attached. I think it's because it was overcooked between the planning late 2019 and the start of the tour summer 2022. As we talked about, it was delayed due to COVID. Do you think there's any chance that they kept tinkering with it and made set A, like, weirder and more unlistenable than it originally was?
Possibly, you know, from reading that AMA and stuff, it seems like they pretty much just, make music all day for themselves.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, in one sense, I could be tinkering with this, or it could just be tinkering with the 8 million other things that they make that we never hear, you know. I don't know that I think it sounds overcooked or anything, but we'll see, you know, as we get deeper into these, you know, this B is not a great thing to compare it to, I think. So, like, once we get to C, maybe we can come back to that question.
Yeah, that's a good point. But I do think, like I was saying earlier, that I think what makes London B sound so special is that it sounds kind of like a little bit off the cuff. Like, it sounds like less worked over than they usually are. And there's something kind of special and fun about that. So I don't know, maybe like undercooked actually turns out being kind of good in that respect. Here's another one from listener Rob. I recently bought all of the NTS sessions on vinyl, and this got me thinking about all the vinyl reissues. Does post-2000 AE belong on CD or digital formats only, or can they be better enjoyed on vinyl format? I know you both got new home audio setups, so I'd be interested to hear which you prefer and why. This is something we talked about a couple times on the original run of the show, but it kind of got me thinking in the context of AE 2022 Dash, like, they do seem to like, regardless of how they blow up the format, they do seem to like to figure out how to release the thing on vinyl. It's like their comfort food, you know. At the end of the day, they love vinyl most or something. I started wondering, like, what if they do a kind of like Aphex Twin Chosen Lords kind of a compilation where it's like their favorite 2022 Dash pieces? Could you imagine something like that working?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if they wanted to, you know, at the end of this or at some point in this, like, say, all right, here's the album version. Or you know what it could remind me of? Like, Boris just released, they have that album Drone Evil. And originally when it came out, it was like two separate discs that you're supposed to play at the same time or some dumb, you know, 2000s gimmick like that. And they just released, they call it Drone Evil Example. And it's like they mixed it together and here you go, here's a version of it. And yeah. I think, like, that would be like a really fun thing for Odd-Techer to do, like, at some point for these things, you know, like give us the, like, example of the
yeah,
full
I love
the full set, you know?
Or not like an example, but like a sampler. Like treat it like that.
Yeah,
where it's
yeah,
like
yeah,
it's perfect. Meant to be like a little taste to get you to want to listen to the whole thing or something like that. But it could still come out on vinyl and people could collect it and it would be cool to listen to. But I think if they maybe wait a little while, it won't have the danger of feeling like the definitive version. It'll feel more like a taste, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I would love that. All right. Listener Josh says, the lack of official track separation has been a big roadblock for me with this project. But now doing it along with the podcast and seeing the very helpful timestamps and suggested track lengths from AE Pages, I feel like it's a lot more fun and exciting that these are all locked in 1 hour long track. Don't get me wrong, if they released an individual track version tomorrow, I would switch to that immediately. But it does feel special to only be able to hear it this way. It's all just so much fun. Now that we're a little ways into it, what do you think about that? Do you just wish still they would just divide it into tracks, or do you think there's some merit in the like one mammoth hour long track at a time approach?
I don't know. I mean, it's sort of fun with this kind of music, and you know, like experimental music and stuff is like my hobby. And so like, I kind of like the academicness of like digging in and having to do the work and them not doing it for you. But, you know, if I was a normal person who, didn't do that, it would probably be better if they did do the work.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't help thinking that it is like, it doesn't bother me so much, but I would definitely prefer individual tracks, like for just ease of listening.
Yeah, for talking
also
about too.
That for sure, but also for the sake of new listeners, which like we've talked about a couple times, I think are missing out on this project because they just don't know what it is or don't get it. And if I literally think that if it just had track titles, then you would realize like, oh shit, these all kind of overlap together and form like one long thing. It would be like almost a fun eureka moment.
I like the thing that we like on the original run of the show and stuff probably complained or joked about the most is like how all their track titles are just so meaningless and like, you know, someone sat on a keyboard and we're like, if only they would mash the keyboard that every 5 minutes and give us some, you know, BS title, you know.
Yeah, it would also, it would be better for my Last.fm and my kind of listening.
Oh, I know. I'm like, when we started doing this podcast, my stats have gone fucking down the toilet.
Well, it's funny because just for my own personal records, I always post on Blue Sky, like, what my like, you know, what's that, Tapsters thing? It just kind of shows like your
chart. 7 days.
And it's funny when Autechre makes it in, because that means I was really listening a hell of a lot if these hour-long tracks made it in. All right, last listener email for today comes from Jackson, who says, do you plan on covering Set D now, or will you wait for the countless, arguably somehow even stronger renditions of that material to drop in batch 3, maybe 2 episodes or something? When it comes to Set D, I think we're definitely going to cover, you know, we'll just have Leon to talk about at the end of this, because that's the only release Set D. I think we'll definitely talk about that, and then we'll just talk about it again whenever the next batch comes out. The bigger question, I think, is, I don't know, are you going to cheat? Are we going to listen to the bootlegs of Set E? Like, are we going to hold off? What's your personal philosophy on that?
I'm just kind of hoping that, like, they beat us and they release them by then, because I think the tour is over now fully or at least getting close to it, and so and again in the AMA it was one of the articles I was reading, it was from around the time of LSEC, and they were talking about, or Sean was talking about, how they have the AE store now and everything, and he was saying, you know, it's like sort of their own personal band camp and they could put things up, and he specifically says like, we could put up a concert, you know, like the next day and stuff, and then they just totally never did that. So hopefully maybe that idea comes back to them and they start releasing these a little quicker. But I do get it, and I enjoy, like, I like how these do feel like some work is done, you know, like they seem, you know, mastered in some sense, and like there's artwork for each one, you know, like I'll take a little bit of waiting to have like the whole accoutrement, but also release them in time for the podcast.
That would be great. Also, yeah, I forgot. I stand corrected. The Lisbon B is also a version of Set D, although it doesn't go nearly as far as Leon. But yeah, we'll have plenty to talk about. We'll have as much to talk about then as we did now with set B. So that you can count on. Anything else, or have we done set B justice?
No, I think that's about it. Next time, no episode next week due to Thanksgiving travel, but a subscribers-only episode will be coming the week after that. We'll be discussing Tranquilizer, the new record from One of Trick's Point Never. Join us by heading over to patreon.com/gonkcast. After that, another main episode on 2022 Dash, going to be set C. So share your thoughts with us via Patreon or email gonkcastpod@gmail.com. If you like the show, help us out, subscribe, leave a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Find us on social media, Instagram, Blue Sky, all that junk. It's Gonkcast Pod, and we'll see you next time.
See ya.